Thanks, Susan. And thank you, Rob, for setting the table. I remember the first time I gave my daughter a bath, I thought my mother-in-law was going to have a heart attack. After 5 days of creating the universe, God began creating creatures to inhabit the land. Living creatures of every kind, wild animals, cattle of every kind, and everything that creeps upon the ground. In Hebrew, it's creeping things that creep upon the ground. I like that. As had been the common refrain on each previous day, the narrator of Genesis declares, God saw that it was good. Finally, in verses 26 and 27, God created humankind according to our likeness in the image of God. Male and female, God created them. Then God blessed the humans and commissioned them to be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, have dominion over fish of the sea and over birds of the air, over every living thing that moves upon the earth. God informed humankind that God had given them every plant upon the face of all the earth, every tree with seed in its fruit to have for food. God then saw everything that God had made, and indeed it was very good. Readers of this text have sometimes claimed that very good was reserved for the humans. It only comes at the end. However, the superlative assessment, very good, applies to the completion of creation. All of the order God had created was very good. Very good applies not only to humans and their subjected animals, but to God's work of bringing order out of chaos, the chaos that existed when God began to create. So the first 5 days, each day, God responded that it was good. Let's review the things God has created. Light and darkness. A dome to hold back the devastating floodwaters. Dry land and seas. Vegetation. The sun, moon, and stars to provide light and rule the days and night. Though not until day four, 3 days after light and darkness, day and night had already been created. Then on day five, fish to fill the sea and birds to fill the sky. Lying behind these 6 days of creative activity is a plan to bring order out of chaos. God's ordering creates a safe living space in which land animals and ultimately humans can survive and, yes, even thrive. When God grants dominion to humankind, it is not intended as granting power to threaten this grand living space. With power to control comes responsibility. Humans have long had a love-fear relationship with the environment, this living space that we inhabit. Wilderness has been seen as both threat and refuge. The Assyrian kings, who lived in the land that we now call Iraq, long ago dominated the ancient Near East for more than 250 years between 859 and 605 BCE. Assyrian kings often boasted about their ability to defeat and destroy their enemies. Indeed, they brutalized them with horrific war crimes. These kings also boasted of their conquest of nature, scaling the highest peaks, crossing the deepest valleys, fording the raging rivers. 2,500 years later, European settlers on this continent, especially those in New England, from which my whole family descends, these New Englanders saw wilderness as something to conquer. The great New Englander, Henry David Thoreau, trumpeted the virtues of wilderness preservation and ridiculed the attitudes of his fellow New Englanders. Famous for his wilderness experiment at Walden Pond, Thoreau's life was cut short at the age of 44 by tuberculosis in 1862. Shortly before he died, he wrote an essay with the wonderful title, Huckleberries. Thoreau complained about fellow citizens who made private property out of virgin forests, riverbanks, and mountaintops in order to exploit them for commerce, for lumber, and for pasture. Thoreau cast a vision in which each town should have a park, or rather a primitive forest of 500 or 1,000 acres, where a stick should never be cut for fuel, nor for the navy, nor to make wagons, but stand and decay for higher uses. A common possession forever, Thoreau imagined, for instruction and recreation. A few years ago, Karen and I visited our daughter in Massachusetts. We went up to New Hampshire for a few days, and on the way back, on a lovely fall day, we stopped at Walden Pond, now a Massachusetts state park. While it is certainly less primitive than when Henry David Thoreau lived there, it is still a lovely retreat, not far from civilization. We hiked around the lake, saw the remains of Thoreau's cabin, and watched as the ducks and loons landed on the pond. A few decades later, John Muir took up the wilderness crusade in the rugged mountains and forests of the West, then less inhabited than New England. Thoreau's wilderness was less wild, more like domesticated wilderness on the borders of modern suburbia. Muir's wilderness was far less tame. Muir said, "Thousands of tired, nerve-shaken, over-civilized people," sounds like today, doesn't it, "are beginning to find out that going to the mountains is going home, that wilderness is a necessity, and that mountain parks and reservations are useful not only as fountains of timber and irrigating rivers, but fountains of life." Muir sounded the theme for subsequent generations. "The mountains are calling," he said, "and I must go." Bruce Barkauer has a wonderful new book out about our national parks, deserts, mountains, coastlines, caves, and much more. As we think about different attitudes of the generations that have gone before us, we see a tug of war between the need to preserve the living space that God established and the desire to conquer the wilderness, to clear-cut forest timber, to dam the rivers, strip mine the minerals, and unleash the byproducts as chaff from winnowed grain tossed into the air for the wind to blow away. To be sure, we live in a post-industrial age. We are the beneficiaries of more than a century and a half of development. James Watt harnessed steam. Thomas Edison and Nikola Tesla learned how to control the electricity that so fascinated Benjamin Franklin. Steam and electricity have shaped our world. Indeed, we have taken advantage of electricity generated from steam-driven turbines, with the steam produced by burning coal, oil, and gas. We have mined and drilled and pumped and refine these fuels in our never-ending quest for electrical power. Certainly, we cannot be so naive as to think we can enjoy the comforts of our modern life without finding ways to generate power. I prepared this sermon on a computer. I am speaking over a powered sound system. We are using thousands of watts of light bulbs and countless BTUs to run the HVAC system. On the other hand, we cannot assume that electricity is a never-ending stream, as plentiful as the waters of the Ohio or the sand on the seashore. I recently discovered a chart created by the U.S. Energy Information Administration. The chart lists the pounds of carbon dioxide given off when various fossil fuels are used to create a million BTUs of energy. Various types of coal, diesel, fuel oil, heating oil, gasoline, propane, and natural gas are all listed on the chart. Coal puts off the most CO2, more than 200 pounds per million BTUs. Natural gas comes at the bottom with 117 pounds. just over half the amount from coal. On the California coast where I grew up, the large utility companies used to burn oil to generate electricity. Two huge power plants, one for the city and one for everyone else, the county, they were located along the coastline. Putting the power plants on the coast allowed the daily ocean breezes to blow away the smoke and the gases. Of course, Los Angeles is ringed with mountains, so all that pollution simply backed up farther inland. As a result, these utility companies began burning natural gas instead of fuel oil a few decades ago. This was long before we were blathering on about CO2 and carbon footprints. While the charts show coal at the top and methane or natural gas at the bottom of the carbon emission chart, both emit a lot of CO2 when used in the quantities necessary to generate all the electricity we need. Now, I am fully aware that there are those of you who don't believe that fossil fuel is connected to rising CO2 levels, and that even if there is a connection, that CO2 levels have varied in the past. They have been higher than they are now. Still, whatever the reason, marine life along the California coast is being scrambled as species from the warmer southern waters are moving north. Polar ice is melting. Generating power is complicated. In some states, coal is easier to use and politically and socially more acceptable. Aside from the fact that coal is available, changing technology is expensive. In some other states, natural gas and hydroelectric is easier to access. But burning natural gas is also something like smoking a low-tar cigarette. People still got cancer from low-tar cigarettes, and natural gas still gives off carbon dioxide and other gases. So, what are we to do? Believe it or not, more than 100 global cities get over 70% of their energy from renewable resources. Some of these cities seem rather remote. Auckland, New Zealand. Nairobi, Kenya. Oslo, Norway. Others are closer to home. Seattle, Washington, my wife's hometown, and Vancouver, Canada, where my aforementioned mother-in-law was born. And more than 40 cities already operate on 100% renewable electricity, including Burlington, Vermont, Basel, Switzerland, and Reykjavik, Iceland. Many more cities have pledged to be 100% renewable within 30 years. The cost of going renewable keeps getting better. Drive across the country in our gasoline-powered autos and see lots of places where wind is powering turbines instead of fuel-generated steam. In some parts of the country, solar is becoming an important energy source. The son of one of our member families converted his home to solar. My cousin has done so. It used to be extremely expensive. Now, it is becoming harder to justify not taking advantage of renewable sources of energy. But it is not just an exotic option for people with the resources to implement. Utility companies are setting up solar farms to generate power for their cities. Why does any of this matter? Why can't we just do what we've always done? My father and mother both began life without automobiles. My dad told me a story from when he was a young boy. He bet a neighbor man, a neighbor of their family's, that the family buggy horse could do a trick. It would roll over on my father's command. Now, aside from the fact that my dad was wrong about the horse, the story made me understand just how far we had come in the 1960s when my dad told me this story. Hearing Dad talk about his childhood, it sounds so distant and remote from the world of Chevys and Fords and Oldsmobiles, the world of jet planes and astronauts going to the moon. And yet, when I look back on it, I realize how much things have changed today since my dad told that story. Computers in nearly every home, cell phones in nearly every hand and pocket. Everything, virtually everything, runs on electricity. In the beginning, when God began to create the heavens and the earth, there was chaos. The earth was without form and void. Darkness covered the face of the chaotic ocean deep. Out of this chaos, God brought order so that life was possible for humanity. We are not gods, but God created us in God's image and tasked us with responsibility to care for God's carefully ordered space in which life is possible. The good news is that it is not impossible to care for creation. We just have to make it a priority to be smart about our energy consumption and to make choices about energy production. We are all partners in God's world. Let's band together as caretakers of a legacy entrusted to us by God and those who came before us. The generations who follow us will be grateful. Amen.